Ira Glass, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, to talk with our WBFO listeners. I'm sure many of whom will be excited to learn that you have a talk coming up here this weekend at the nearby Chautauqua Institution. So you are, of course, the creator, producer, and host of the public radio program and popular podcast, This American Life. Your voice must be one of the most recognized in the country. This American Life is aired on more than 500 public radio stations nationwide, including this one, WBFO, and downloaded by another 2.5 million people around the world. So This American Life was an early pioneer of this narrative audio storytelling that we're so used to hearing now these days. Can you tell me about how you feel about your contribution to that, this renaissance of public radio?
Yes, and hi.
Hi, Ira.
Hi. How do I feel about that? It's been a surprise that the kind of thing that we do in This American Life, where there are stories with a plot and characters and scenes and feelings and all of that, that it's caught on as a thing that other people do. Like when the show went on the air in 1995, it was just very much like my feeling about it and the feeling of the people who put it together was just like, oh, this is just like a kind of thing that we like. And it's really only in the last decade that other people have started to kind of do shows like it. Most of them as podcasts, and a lot of them kind of great. And so, I mean, I'm glad that other people are working in this form, because I feel like radio is a really satisfying way to hear stories and to hear emotional stories. And I like listening to the shows that, you know, that do this kind of thing. So I'm glad there's more of it.
That was something I was going to ask you, but I'll just bring it up right now since you mentioned it. Does Ira Glass listen to other people's podcasts? And if so, what are you listening to?
Well, I feel like I should pull up my phone to actually like read off of it who I'm listening to right now. I mean, the podcast that I listen to more than any other is the one that the New York Times puts out called The Daily, which,
right,
if anybody hasn't heard it, I totally recommend. It's like 20 minutes a day. They do one story. It's narrative. So it's like a story with a plot to it, not. I don't know. It's just like it's done beautifully. Like it's just a really it's a great thing to listen to. Beyond that, my other favorite podcast right now, Reply All. I'm still a Radiolab fan. But then there's podcasts that aren't story podcasts that I listen to. I started listening to like Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert. Somebody recommended Red Scare, and I've been listening to that for a little while. What else? Like it varies a lot, actually. I'm always kind of like tooling around looking for new things.
Well, that's great. Thank you for sharing some of those. And for some of our listeners who maybe haven't heard This American Life, can you give us your elevator pitch about this show?
Yes, I can. I've totally practiced this. What we're doing is mostly it's journalism, but the way that the stories go is that they sort of unfold like little movies for radio. Like there's characters and scenes and a plot. I think there's a certain kind of old school public radio show that a person listens to because we feel like it will make us a better person, you know, a better citizen or a more informed person. That is not what we're shooting for with This American Life. We feel like we want the stories to be things you just kind of get caught up into and want to hear what's going to happen.
Right. But you did come through NPR and
yes,
you started as an intern, you know, at the NPR headquarters in D.C., right?
Yes, absolutely. When I was 19.
So how did you get into radio in the first place? Is it true that your dad worked in radio?
It is true that my dad worked in radio, but I didn't actually know that growing up. He was in college radio at the University of Maryland and started the radio station, I think, at the University of Maryland. And or at least that's the story he tells. It might be true. And then tried to do radio while he was in the Army, actually stationed in Virginia, and on his weekends. And then once he started having kids, he felt like there was no way to make a living and it was too uncertain of a future, and got out of it when he was 23, I think.
Oh, that's amazing. And, that's pretty wonderfully ironic.
Yeah, so I did not grow up with any idea of him being somebody who did radio. I didn't, you know, like honestly, I didn't know that much about it. It wasn't a big part of his identity. He became a certified public accountant, which he made more money than he thought he would ever make in radio. And he was very much against me going into radio from the beginning, like just was just dead set against it for the reasons that, that he thought he shouldn't go into it. Like he, the logic still seemed valid, if anything more valid, because I was working for so little money at NPR, like as a production assistant and at the low level jobs. My financial goal was to make my age times 1,000 per year, which I achieved in my mid 30s. Finally, I finally made my age times 1,000 when I was 34, 35. I finally did. So yeah. Like, but my parents came around. They finally did come around.
Right. Well, now fast forward, you know, a cool 30 years or so, and everybody wants to make a podcast, right? Everyone's pitching the next, you know, hot podcast and hoping it's going to be theirs.
It's crazy to me, the people who I hear are, like, doing podcasts. Yes. Yeah. Like the Michael Lewis, for example, the greatest nonfiction writer in the country who did The Blind Side and The Big Short and Moneyball, like that he would be just like, in addition to doing his regular job writing the greatest nonfiction books in the country, he would also decide he was going to do a podcast. I just feel like, really? You too? Everybody has to do one now?
Do you feel like now you just have more competition? You know, do you worry about competition?
There definitely is more competition. Absolutely. There's you know, hundreds of thousands of podcasts out there. There's tons of competition. Do I worry about competition? I worry more just about like just keeping our show feeling new and exciting. Like more than I think about like, oh, who else is doing well. Like I'm fine with other people having successful shows.
Well, so speaking of your show, I do want to mention that. So we actually had the opportunity to meet before. I was one of the CUNY, you know, City University of New York graduate students in journalism who you graciously welcomed into This American Life to sit in, you know, a couple of us at a time at a weekly pitch meeting with a whole staff. And
yes.
That was such a great opportunity. Are you still doing that with the CUNY J School, can I ask?
We are not still doing that. No. And we might get back to it, actually. But there was a period where people just felt like we wanted to have, like a conversation that was just staff without other people there. And honestly, the staff was getting so big, we felt like, oh, there's so many people in this meeting.
Sure.
So so we might go back to it at some point, but not right now.
Well, I am extremely grateful that I was in that lucky cohort who got to do that. And I want to talk about what I saw in that room.
Yeah, I'd be very curious because it's just like a bunch of people talking about, like, should we do this?
But for someone who's still in journalism school, or I think I had just graduated at that point, it's all you want to do is to be part of those conversations, to actually be making radio and, you know, sharing stories and doing this thing that you've studied and you feel like you know how to do it. Like, you just want the opportunity to get there. So it was an awesome opportunity.
But were the conversations any different than the ones that you were having with your, you know, with the other students when you were trying to figure out your stories? Like, was there something that we were doing that seemed different?
Well, I think certainly the material that you had to choose from, like our, you know, first semester at CUNY, you have a community board district in New York City. And so you're looking for stories just in your beat and they're really local. You know, you are like going to community board meetings and any new development in the neighborhood or, you know, something with NYCHA or some kind of protest, you know, you're just like grasping for stuff. So clearly there's a lot more submitted to This American Life. Like, I was floored by the amount of pitches you guys get and, you know, how many stories you have to choose from so you can really seek out, like, the best ones that fit for, you know, any given theme for that
week. Yeah, no, it's true. And we reject a lot of things, too. Like there's so much material that we go through, you know, knowing that we're going to be just picking the ones that we think will be the very best stories.
Well, I mean, it clearly shows in how the podcast comes out. You know, the final product every week is just wonderful. But I wanted to talk about your staff, which, as you mentioned, is large and also very diverse, quite young, very heavily female, it seems to me, at least.
It is very female. But that's true in public radio in general, I think, just because I think traditionally it's been lower paying jobs. From the time I was in public radio in the 70s, it was true.
Well, I wanted to know about how that diversity, you know, how do you feel that it gives strength to your show?
I mean, that is, the diversity is something we have actively cultivated and went out of our way as a staff to make happen. And it's completely essential to doing a show in modern America. I mean, like there's no way to actually document what's happening in this country with the level of nuance that I think the audience wants without a staff that's just as diverse as the country is.
Do you ever face any generational differences between like you and your staff?
Yes, absolutely. It happens.
It doesn't happen
a lot, but like honestly, like we haven't gotten into like there haven't been big. I really have to think about if there have been times where there are big disagreements. Sometimes it'll be like word choices that will just, you know, the younger staff would be like, you literally can't say that word anymore. And the one that comes to mind is one that we actually talked about on the air, and that was that I wrote in a story, I called somebody a Jew, and I am a Jew. And I remember one of the younger staffers was just like, you can't say that. You have to say Jewish people.
I remember listening to this conversation.
I think I get a pass on this one.
You're like, this is how I describe myself. I mean,
yeah, I feel like it's the one, it's the only, but honestly, it's the only one where I can sort of say like, no, this is my group. I think I'm okay saying this myself.
Yeah.
But there definitely have been other things like that. There haven't been, so there's definitely been like wording choice things. Where people will just say, like, we don't say that anymore to me. And I just want to say, like, the other older staffers. Let me think if there have been – I'm not sure if I remember if there have been, like, story disagreements. There was one disagreement. Yeah, there was one in particular that I feel like broke down on a mix of generational and racial lines.
Mm.
And it was right after that – it was right after that neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Charlottesville, Virginia. That's right.
Yeah, in 2017.
Yeah. It was right after that neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and one of our producers got an interview with the organizer of the rally, and there came a point where a bunch of staffers were just like I don't want to hear what this guy has to say. Like I don't see why we should give him any airtime with his beliefs. And for me and the older producers, we were very much on the lines of like, yes, if we were just having him on and having him say whatever he wanted, we would agree with that. But in an interview where we're aggressively asking questions and where he's not just spouting off his beliefs, but we're really interrogating him, I feel like it's possible to do a responsible interview with a person where it won't just feel like they're proselytizing and bringing in new followers. But that was definitely something that people on staff disagreed about. Like the old school journalists on staff, like myself, we definitely felt like there's a way to do this that's responsible and is not helping this person get attention and find new neo-Nazis. And younger staffers and non-white staffers, there was a feeling not just like they weren't sure it was true, but also there was a kind of weird, I don't know, like I don't want to like mischaracterize the way people felt.
No, that's really
with
interesting.
The distance of time. But there was a question of, is that actually possible? But also I think part of it was just an emotional, I'm tired of hearing this from this guy's perspective. I don't need to hear another white person explain why they're racist. You know,
right.
Which I understand.
Right. And
partly it's just a question on the entire angle of the story of like, why are we trying to understand this person better? Why are we trying to see who they are better? Why do we need to do that? Why does anybody need to do that at this point? And I have to say like, yeah, like there was not complete agreement on staff about that.
Right. And that it just does seem like part of a larger, you know, national conversation that we're having now. Like we're seeing this, you know, in Congress, even right now as we speak. And so it's never, those conversations can be uncomfortable, of course, but that's also part of being a reporter and a journalist. And we are going to talk about your talk next, but I did want to ask you, you know, what are some of the most uncomfortable reporting situations that you've been in over your career? And is there anything that you really don't like to report on or do? Because it seems like This American Life really does a little bit of everything.
I mean, I am not a person who relishes asking people questions that put them on the spot. Certain people are great at that and also have kind of a fire in the belly for it. Like they're people who really want to uncover injustice and confront the powerful. And I feel like I can do it, and I do it in stories. And I always just have to like take a deep breath and be like, all right, what am I going to say? How am I going to say it? Like, how's this going to go when they say this? What am I going to say back? Like, I totally have to gather myself to do it. Like, that is not the kind of thing that comes to me naturally in any way. Whereas there are some reporters that like they actually relish that part of interviewing and that kind of story. And they're great at it as a result. They don't have to think it through in that way. It's just instinctual to them, like how to go about it. So that is definitely something I grapple with. I'm way more comfortable in the kind of interview where I'm trying to understand somebody and trying to get inside their world and inside their head.
Yeah, and what does seem, tell me if I'm wrong, but what does seem like it comes naturally to you is that you bring such a joy and enthusiasm for your work, and that, it seeps through everything This American Life does. And I have to say, it was such a joy to prepare for this interview, because I was just thinking back about all my favorite moments and all my favorite stories, and I would just like find myself laughing and remembering these really fun
this
moments.
This is super nice of you to say. That's really, really nice. Thank you. Like, I feel like it's not just me, like the entire staff. Like, we're trying to make a show that will amuse us as people, like making a thing. And so, yeah, like in any story, even very serious stories, like I feel like there'll often be moments that are kind of like surprising and funny and just something that we notice along the way that just seems like a fun thing to point out to an audience.
Right. And there's always something, I feel like I always end up reflecting on something having to do with, the universal human experience. And then I'm kind of like, wait, how did this even happen? I thought I was just going to listen to a podcast for an hour. And now I'm, either crying or laughing along with this, complete stranger.
I mean, if you're crying, that's absolutely, great. like if you're having feelings that are that strong, I feel like in a really great story it'll be like funny at the beginning and then pull a person in, and then we'll be really emotional by the end.
Okay, so let's talk about how you tell a story, and also this relates to what you'll be speaking about this Saturday, right? So what can people expect at your talk at Chautauqua on Saturday?
So what this is, I mean, basically, like, I've been going on doing talks, and I had to come up with a way to kind of figure out, like, here's what I'm going to make. And so it's a talk called Seven Things I've Learned. And some of them are sort of hard fought things that I've learned about making stories and being a reporter. But most of them are really just like really like wonderful stories, funny stories to tell an audience on stage. And I stand on stage with an iPad and some notes and basically play clips and play videos, and mostly things that have not been on the radio. Some of them never could be on the radio. And a fair amount of like video content that we've made over the years that I think most people don't know, and play little clips from that as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I mean, I will say I don't think I've watched too many of This American Life videos, but I know that the show, it did have a brief run as a TV show too, right?
Yeah, we did a thing as a TV show. And in fact, one of the stories that I'll probably tell at Chautauqua is a story that we did 10 years ago on television, and then I did a follow-up that I filmed for the speech with one of the people in one of those old stories. So I play a little bit of the old story, but then all the stuff that's happened since, because it's fascinating what's happened since.
Oh, wow. How great. Okay. Have you spent much time in Western New York before?
No, I know. I mean, I've been up to Western New York a couple of times, but haven't spent much time.
Okay. Well, we're excited to have you here in the region.
I know it would be such a good thing if I could say something about like some local thing, but I got nothing.
That's okay. Between us, I'm also pretty new to the region myself. I'm originally from upstate New York and lived in the city, and now I'm here. So I just like continue my march across New York State.
Got it.
So when you're on the road, I just imagine that people want to come up to you and tell you stories all the time. Is that true?
It's a little bit true. It's less true than you would think. Like usually there'll be a reception for the public radio station when I give a talk like this, and I'll meet 50 or 60 people, and one person will pitch a story. I think people are a little shy about that.
That surprises me, but maybe it's because I'm always thinking about stories myself.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that too. Like, when was the last time that you did something just purely for fun? Are you working all the time?
I mean, I'm working really long hours, yes. But I don't know, I hung out with a friend and her six-year-old on Sunday and tried to teach him to ride a bike, you know, like, which was kind of fun. I don't know. There's a technique that that my around the corner neighbor taught me when I was a kid to teach that. Basically, he bragged that he could teach anybody to ride a bike in 10 minutes and did teach me to ride a bike in 10 minutes. And so I got to try that out on this 6-year-old this weekend.
Wow. Wait, when did you learn how to ride a bike?
I mean, when I was a kid.
Oh, okay. You know?
Okay. but like, you know, like I was an older kid. Like I was over 10 years old before I learned to ride a bike. I was not athletic, and our around the corner neighbor, Ron Goldman, who bragged to all the children that he was the best dad in the neighborhood, and in fact had a song that he would make all the neighborhood kids sing in the backyard about how he was the best dad in the neighborhood. He was like a real, really wonderful man.
That's amazing.
But anyway, so he basically, when he learned, when I was like 11 or 12 and I hadn't learned to ride a bike because I was like a chubby, unathletic kid, he's like, I can teach anybody to ride a bike in 10 minutes. And then taught me a technique that where you run alongside the kid and have them pedal as you go down a hill. And as long as your one instruction to the kid is keep pedaling. And as long as they keep pedaling, they kind of stay up. And after they do it two or three times, they can stay up. I got to try that out. Well, I haven't tried this on anybody in years, and got to do it with a 6-year-old this weekend. It was really fun.
That sounds actually great. And so is the six-year-old now successfully riding a bike?
Semi, okay. I would say. Semi. Okay. He was a little bit timid, and so I think we're going to – like he started to get the feeling of it, and then he'd had enough for the day. And so I have to say that the Ron Goldman technique did not pan out in 10 minutes for the first time ever, actually. I have taught other people that way.
Okay. Well, I hope you get to try again soon. Ira Glass, thank you again. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak with WBFO today.
Thanks so much. Nice to talk to you.